Hard to imagine life in Wisconsin without access to our wonderful natural areas and the wildlife that are out there inhabiting those areas. And no matter what the season, it's really one of the best things about our state, I think. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Fortunate to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven back with us. He comes by every month to share what he's been seeing and to help you and I understand what's going on out there. And Scott, good to see you again.
It's good to be back, Larry.
Yeah, wonderful to see you.
Although it was nice to be in Florida last week, but this is okay.
Yeah, what was Florida like?
It was cool when we got there. And of course, this cold is all over the country, but it did warm up to 80 a couple of days. And I'll tell you what, that felt pretty good. And we I poked around in the Ding Darling Wildlife Refuge on Sanibel Island a couple times.
Uh-huh.
Watch the bird life and just generally soak in a little sun. It's not only is it a great getaway for all the oppressed people in the northern two-thirds of the country, but there is a lot of cool bird life, and the alligators were out, and it was just nice to see something green.
Yeah, after how many months?
It's been a long stretch, and it's not only hard on us, it's
got to be hard. Yeah, definitely. Well, and the deer, I really wonder about the deer herd this year.
Well, this comes on the heels of a bad winter last year from the deer standpoint, especially in the North Woods, and this is certainly not what anyone was hoping for. The Winter Severity Index, which is the DNR's measure of how bad things are, how serious things are, has already hit severe levels in a few reporting stations. That's a product of days, I think, with 18 inches of snow or more and days below zero. And they've, over the years, refined that into what it relates to in terms of potential deer mortality. And I think when it hits severe, you're talking about potential losses of 20 or 30% or more of the herd in that area.
Wow.
Not necessarily, but potentially. So it's it's not good, and a matter of fact, the DNR has asked for help from the public to report dead deer as they track the winter's toll, and they're hoping that people will call in and let them know what they're seeing and where. And there's also, of course, a reminder this brings up very quickly as soon as you start talking about deer that are having trouble. That means feeding raises its ugly head, and generally speaking, the recommendations are still: don't feed, and if you insist on it, you need to follow the regulations, which in non-CWD or adjoining counties still limit feeding to 2 gallons per site, and there are placement restrictions and restrictions on how close you can be to a highway posted over 45 miles an hour. So if you're going to insist on feeding, check out the legality of the whole thing and ask for some counsel. Straight corn is not a particularly healthy diet for deer as ruminants. So there are some things you can do if you insist on doing it, and I fully understand that you see a deer out there all fluffed up and looking pretty forlorn. That tugs at most people's heartstrings and say, what can I do for that animal? I understand that, but if you're going to do something, try and do it in the best possible way. So bottom line is, it's a tough winter, and if listeners have made any interesting observations of animals of any kind, wild turkeys, deer, or anything else that seem to either be, hey, they're getting by pretty well, or, uh-oh, things are looking pretty bad. I guess we'd like to hear about it.
Well, Patty in Oregon has a comment relating to deer, I believe, and eagles. Patty, hi.
Hi, Larry. It's a perfect timing. I have a farm in Oregon that I live on, and for the last month, quite a few animals have been attracted to my bird feeder, which is a big dead buck. And
a deer.
I have seen eagles quite a few times in the last month, which we don't usually see in Oregon, both young and fully grown eagles, and have heard coyotes at this carcass many times fighting over the carcass, and of course all kinds of crows and things. So on my farm, animals are being fed quite a lot from this big carcass.
So this is a deer that just died, succumbed somehow, and
It looks that way. We couldn't find any holes in it from shells
or
rifle slugs, so it looks that way.
Yeah.
Well, it could have been hit by a car, too, but it also, I mean, in this area, it always makes you nervous, a dead deer just lying around, especially an adult buck. You worry about chronic wasting disease, too.
Yeah.
So it's too late to probably test that, but anyway, yeah. That's also a possibility. But Jerry Davis, the outdoor writer, had an interesting column Sunday about putting out some deer rib cages from his post-season venison processing and put them in a place where they were highly visible. And
yeah,
he's been trying to attract a golden eagle out there in Iowa County, and he's attracted all sorts of stuff. And when a deer does, or parts of deer, gut piles or whatever, after the hunting season are left behind, they don't last very long.
No.
Every scrap goes to use. But it's the carnivores probably aren't doing too badly. It's the herbivores, like the deer and the other animals, that are having trouble finding waste grain or plant food, and they succumb. And then the coyotes and foxes and things like that, it's fat city as far as they're concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. Patty, thanks so much. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way, if you have a question. Maybe you have a wildlife story you want to tell us, a sighting, or maybe a question about the wildlife, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. We'd certainly love to hear from you. We've got lots of emails and Facebook comments here. An email from Philippe Cocar from Wallersheim Winery. A friend at the winery and I are concerned that we've not seen cardinals around like other years. We wonder if other people are experiencing that, too. What might be happening? Is it temporary because of the cold or something else? And then sort of to pair that, this is a sort of comment as well. We had a Facebook photo and a comment from Sue in Oshkosh, who has a photo of a tree in their backyard in Oshkosh with a flock of robins. And they have been in Oshkosh all winter, so she's wondering if that's common. So in one case, in Baraboo area, we've got Philippe's not seeing any cardinals. And in Oshkosh, Sue's got all these robins.
On the cardinal front, I was just, I think it was night before last, the cardinals tend to come in early and really late, just before dark. And I've got feeders on both decks in the back of the house, and on one feeder outside the bedroom, there were four pairs of cardinals squabbling around on the one feeder, and I'm not sure how many on the other one. So I actually saw that, and my experience over the last month or so is, for me at least, it's been a great winter for cardinals. Not so much any of the more unusual stuff from the far north, but I've had lots of juncos, lots of cardinals, a few good woodpeckers, the usual family of blue jays, and a few other odds and ends, chickadee family and so forth. But lots
probably
of cardinals.
Plenty of sparrows.
Maybe
too.
All Philippe's cardinals moved down to my place, but I've not heard of anything that would suggest cardinals are in any way having any problems. So that's that. The robin issue is a chronic curiosity during the winter, and there are some places in the state that are notorious for overwintering robins. In fact, we talked, I think, last month about the 50 or more that I saw in the thorn apple trees or hawthorn trees outside the dry cleaners a month or so ago.
Yeah.
So they do hang around, particularly areas where there's a little open water. And things like the Wingress Springs and the Arboretum usually harbor robins. La Crosse is another area where people report robins. But if they can find trees with persistent fruits like high bush cranberry, thorn apple, mountain ash, things like that, they seem to do okay.
Yeah.
Now, they may have regretted their decision at this point, but to stay.
Yeah.
But they'll probably do okay.
Tim sent a Facebook photo of a robin who came to their heated bird bath during a recent cold snap. That heated bird bath is the best thing we've done for our bird friends and have given us lots of winter viewing fun.
Okay, another good idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Glenn and Stevens Point, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. A couple of sightings I've had. One in particular at the base of our bird feeding. We feed all winter long and have quite an array of birds, but the biggest bullies of all are the blue jays.
Yep.
And we found a dead one at the base of our bird feeder one day, which was unusual. And during that cold spell that we had, where it was always 15 below or colder. That was one sighting. The other sighting I had, and we live pretty rural, was walking out to my mailbox one day, at the base of my feet in my driveway, a red-bellied woodpecker fell to my feet and was flip-flopping back and forth and flip-flopped into the deeper snow and then onto a little branch and then jumped up into a cedar tree. And that was the last I saw him. So he looked like he was in distress, too. And just one other comment about a deer that I harvested, that was a car-hit deer.
Mm-hmm.
When I cleaned it up, very little fat on it. And that was about a month ago. Very, very little fat. I was kind of surprised. So those are my settings.
Okay.
And I'll take the call offline.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
Well, I mean, as far as dead birds around feeders are concerned, especially blue jays, which are prone to some disease problems that are going around. I haven't heard much about feeder-borne diseases or things like West Nile and whatnot this winter. But and especially a red-bellied neither a red-bellied woodpecker nor a blue jay should be particularly troubled by what's going on, especially if they've got access to feeders. So when you start to see birds flip-flopping or undistress or dead where they probably didn't hit a window or get nailed by a Cooper's hawk or something, I guess I'd recommend to Glenn that if he finds any more like that to double bag them in plastic and maybe get them submitted for testing to see if there is any disease problems. That would be a little more problematic than just the impacts of winter. And those are two species that really shouldn't be suffering much no matter how cold it gets, especially if he's got very active feeders.
Yeah. Yep.
So we'll see.
Jerry sent us on Facebook. Here is quite a picture. He found this headless rabbit on a birdhouse. And there it sits last Sunday. Wondering if, would an owl do this? There are owls, hawks, and coyotes in the area. Well, a coyote's not going to get it up on that birdhouse.
No, that looks like the work of a great horned owl. They will often take the heads off prey, and it may have gotten it up there and either with plans to return or plans to finish it off and got distracted by something else. But that looks most likely, unless there were human footprints around and there was some, you know, somebody else found it in the trail and just sat it up there, that's most likely owl work.
Yeah, okay. Here's a sharpshinned, a photo on Facebook of a sharpshinned enjoying a blue jay for lunch. Meredith sent that one. And Tim Zander sent it. He said, this is a critter I trapped around our yard. What is it? It's not like the moles I've seen before in our yard. We are in Wisconsin Rapids. And I am trying to, I don't know the size of it. That's the problem. I'm having trouble with it. Scott, what
Well,
do you...
it doesn't matter. It's a vole.
It is a vole.
Which vole? I'm not altogether sure because of the exposure, but it's a vole, probably a meadow vole, Microtus pennsylvanicus, but it doesn't seem to have enough rusty red on the back to be a red-backed vole. And just on the basis of probabilities, there are half a dozen species in the state, but around a yard or a house, most likely the meadow vole, and a very, very, very common animal, active all winter beneath the snow. And that's the one that's problematic for your shrubbery and that kind of thing and dwarf fruit trees and whatnot, where they do their damage to the bark under the protective blanket of snow. So anyway, that's what he's got. And if I caught one this time of year, I'd be a little nervous about my landscape vegetation.
But yeah,
we'll see when the snow melts.
Oh, man. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in here on the Ideas Net, talking about the world of wildlife today with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven, Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Call us at 800-642-1234. We've already had some great photos. I see there's another one up here from Susanna, I believe, who sent a photo of the robins, a whole flock of robins in her tree.
That's a lot of robins.
That's a lot of robins. You can join us, post your own photo at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, or call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Lyman in McFarland, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi there. I've got a bird mystery here.
Okay.
Last May, beginning of May, I was upstairs. My wife and I were both upstairs, and we saw this strange bird in the top of our cherry tree. We got a very good look at it for at least 10 seconds, you know, only 20 or so feet away. It looked exactly like a blue jay. Its beak looked like a blue jay. It acted like a blue jay. They have this way of hopping from branch to branch without, you know, without unfurling their wings.
Yeah.
Only it had really straggly feathers. It was charcoal gray. The feathers were kind of matted almost, and instead of having a neat little top knot that swept back like a blue jay, it had a spiky mohawk. And I just can't figure out what it was other than a really strange mutant blue jay. It couldn't have been a juvenile because there weren't even any baby robins out at the time, and it was completely full size, and then it flew off. Any ideas?
Huh. Have you been through your bird books to check some of the jay relatives that might have just been here, you know, off course kind of thing? I mean, we do have a northern jay in Wisconsin called the gray jay or whiskey jack,
yeah,
is one of the local names.
Oh, I'm familiar with
okay,
all those.
So,
we have bird books, and we've gone bird watching here and out west. And
so not a Steller's jay from the west or
no,
a gray jay from the north.
Nope,
well,
nope, I know exactly what
okay.
those birds look like. And as I said, it was almost black, and its feathers were such that it almost looked like it was, you know, recovering from an oil spill. It really looked like some kind of a mutant.
Hmm.
But I just wanted to bring that up just in case somebody else would have seen something like that.
In a circumstance like that, you seem to know your birds, so the likelihood of something really weird from off course probably isn't the case. And if you describe it as jay size, jay behavior, then it may very well have been a jay that ran into who knows what that,
yeah.
you know, that discolored it or mm-hmm. injured it or otherwise modified it to look. Give it the weird appearance that you observed, and that's
about all we can guess on
yeah.
that one.
Yeah. It was startling to the point of being shocking. You know, like, you know, what in the world am I looking at? And as I said, we had a very good look at it for about 10 seconds, not more than 20 feet away. And
well, the good news okay. here is it remains a mystery, so you can continue to ponder for a while. If we'd resolved it for you, all the fun would have gone out of it. So.
There you go. That's one way to look at it, Lyman. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, my goodness. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. You know, we had Groundhog Day when come and gone, and
those
groundhogs.
You know,
they agreed, too. That's the
everybody seemed to agree that, you know, it was a sunny day. Seeing their shadow is inevitable. So, okay, 6 more weeks of winter. It seems like we've had 6 months of winter already. But it's an interesting folk tale kind of thing. And, you know, they're either going to be right or they're wrong, 50-50. So what can you say? I think the interesting thing is that they get these hibernating animals up, essentially, and drag them out to see if they see their shadow, woodchuck and groundhog being the same thing.
Yep.
So the wild ones all had, I think, better presence of mind, stayed down in their burrows, sound asleep, and didn't even poke out. But
there it was. There you have it. Chuck in Lake Delton, hi. Thank you for calling.
I got all the robins from Sauk down there, so I mean all the cardinals, but anyway, I was going to say I had two starlings at my feeder here, and it was like 8-10 below.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they kind of cleared out during the bad part, but because I've been down south when the starlings came from the north, and I mean it's just you couldn't even hear yourself think down there when they were in the trees.
Yeah, the starlings and other blackbirds gather in unbelievable flocks in the southern states during the winter, but enough of them hang around here, especially if you're even within a few miles of any kind of a livestock operation. They'll hang around the open feed buildings and that kind of thing for most of the winter. So a couple of stragglers moving to your feeder isn't too surprising.
Yeah.
Doggone it. I was kind of hoping they were harbingers of spring. But
no. I don't think there are any harbingers of spring available yet. And you know, all these robins people are seeing, I guess we can't count them as the first robin of spring. That kind of muddies the water a little bit in terms of figuring out what's going on.
But I'm telling you, 6 weeks, I'm thinking, 6 weeks? Is that all that we're going to have left? You hope it's only 6 weeks.
That's true. I mean, that'd be even latter part of March, but
we had snow in April last year in southern Wisconsin. So,
And May were brutal last year. That's what did in the last of the pheasants and caused most of the wildlife problems. But here we are. I hope now you've depressed me. If it goes into April and May again, I was actually thinking about digging out my little peat pots and some potting soil and all, and trying to figure out when I should be starting some garden plants, but it's too early.
Too early
so
for that.
I've got to hold myself back.
caller Paul thinks that mystery jay-like bird could have been a molting cardinal. They've had them, and there is a similarity. So a molting cardinal,
could be possible. A female cardinal is grayish and has a mangy-looking topknot. So I have to go here that Lyman seemed to know his birds pretty well, and a cardinal's, not quite as
a big molting as a, female, though.
But not as big as a jay.
No.
We don't want to break that mystery open.
Charlotte.
But it's possible.
Charlotte in rural Marquette County. Hi.
Well, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Since late December, we have had bluebirds at our heated bird bath, anywhere from 2 to 6, and we see them almost every day.
Very cool.
Oh, it's just such a thrill. And if I was on the internet, I would send you a picture. I've been taking photographs, but I'm not on the internet.
Oh.
Well, but much like the robins, a few bluebirds do hang around, too.
What the heck do they eat?
Can I ask you, we have a lot of red cedar trees, and they had a large abundance of those blueberries. Mm-hmm. Do they eat those?
I think they do. If they're really pressed.
We have robins, too, and I've seen a lot of birds in those trees, and I keep thinking that's the only thing I can think of. But I put out some raisins and some currants, and I think they might be eating a little bit of that. I don't have any mealworms. I guess that's their really what
that's,
they like the most.
I was going to suggest that if you want to put something out that will really help them, the raisins and currants or chopped fruits are really great for the robins, and there are actually some commercial berry or fruit mixes that would be good for them. The bluebirds would really like some mealworms.
That's what I figured.
Just to go along with that, Todd in Delavan has had, for the past 4 years, has had 3 bluebirds overwintering, and he thinks it's the same because there's always 3. There's never 2 or 4. It's always 3.
Yeah. Well, a few years ago, we had 4 or 5, but then we hadn't seen them. But
well, he was wondering why the heck they don't just go south. Is there,
we'll have to interview them, Larry. And,
thinking the same thing.
Some, from an evolutionary standpoint, for whatever reason, some remain behind. Those that make it through the winter, they may not have, had they known what they were in for this winter, they may have reconsidered. But if they make it, they've saved all that energetic commitment to migration, the long, dangerous flight down, the long, dangerous flight back. And, when things begin to moderate, they're the first on the scene to claim the best nesting territory, the nicest bluebird house that somebody just put up. I mean, they're right here and get a jump start on the breeding season, which is what it's all about for these animals. So if they make it through the winter, there's some advantage to that strategy. But I think over the long haul, the strategy is, we're not going to make it through the winter. We need to migrate. Some buck the odds a little bit.
Thanks again, Charlotte, for calling. Travis in Wausau, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on, and what a great show today. Last week, Tuesday, which was one of the coldest days of the year, for about 45 minutes right below our feeder, we had a raptor of some sort that was eating a mourning dove. And I was doing my best to book it. It looked very much like a peregrine falcon. I know we have them in the area, but I don't know if they're here in the wintertime. It had some feathers on its legs. It was smaller, 12, 13, 14 inches or so. It wasn't a Swainson's hawk. it didn't look quite like a Cooper's hawk because it didn't have the white bandish, you know, on the back of the head. It definitely had black striations on the tail. I know the peregrine is, you know, eats a lot of doves. Any idea what that could have been?
When you talk about the larger hawks, the Swainson red tail, rough leg, those are all, you know, short tail, larger hawks and not generally bird eaters. When you get into the bird eaters, on the small side, it's the sharp shin, then the Coopers, then the goshawk.
Oh, yeah.
And then on up, well, the peregrine would fit in there. Much less likely that it's a peregrine.
That's what I thought.
Probably not at 13 or 14 inches. Oh, tell me the size of the bird compared to the mourning dove. A Sharpie wouldn't be much bigger than the mourning dove.
Oh, it was definitely considerably bigger. I would say twice the size.
Okay, then the odds are best that, you know, despite the plumage variation, there's quite a bit of variation in age classes and sex as far as the Coopers are concerned. But just on the basis of odds, eating a bird at a feeder in Wisconsin this time of year, Coopers is the best bet.
Mm-hmm.
But, and a goshawk would be even a little larger, but marked similarly. But those are the two I'd concentrate on in your bird books and look at enough bird books or images online that you can match up the plumage.
Okay, and that's what I was kind of thinking, but it didn't have those white bands by the eyes like the goshawk, and it was much darker than the typical goshawk. It was
okay, then I still think you focus in on Coopers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. And let's go to Dave in Strunk's Corner, Michigan. Hello, Dave.
Hello. How you doing?
Great. Good. Appreciate your call.
I live about 10 miles south of Lake Superior in the Upper Peninsula. And, of course, our winters make yours look like child's play. But I drive truck back and forth to Minnesota all week, and I noticed starting in December when it got really cold, I usually see tons of small birds on the shoulder of the road in Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not seeing any other than ravens. And a friend of mine found one on the hood of his car after I mentioned that to him, and he said it was flopping around. He picked it up, put it in his hands, and he took it inside and warmed it up for a while, and he said then it seemed like it came back to life, and he went back outside, and flew right off. And I wonder how many birds do die of freezing to death.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there are lots of mortality factors for all of these creatures, and it's a lucky small bird that makes it for a few years. Their longevity is not great. The largest flocks of roadside birds in the winter, and what you saw early on that may have just moved out, are the horned larks and the snow buntings and species like that that come down from the north in large flocks and love to hang out on the roadside, flush when a vehicle goes by, and they end up during the dead of winter down here in southern Wisconsin, where, as you said, it's so balmy and beautiful, along the fields and cut lines and road banks in agricultural country, and that's where we see them for a short period, and then they're gone again and headed back north. A lot of other birds will use the roadside when gravel and grit and so forth is exposed or spilled grain or whatever, but most of that's long gone or frozen in or buried in the snow, so these birds have moved on. I suspect the larks and buntings and so forth are down here rather than up in your country at this point.
Well, yeah, I'm not a bird expert, but I usually see probably chickadees, some of them are, but normally there's, even all winter long, I normally see birds on the shoulder. Of course, you know what? Harder anyhow. They're plowing the road every day, so there's always.
Well, there's a lot of disturbance. A lot of the shoulders disappeared under snow, so I think that they've, small groups of family groups of chickadees and whatnot have probably moved back into cover or found a feeder somewhere. But the big flocks of migrating birds are probably further south than you right now.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in. Call us at 800-642-1234, email us at talk@wpr.org, or post on my Facebook page. Lots of great photos on the page. And if you've got a good wildlife photo or an interesting one, or maybe there's something you've taken a photo of you might want to get ID'd, we can do that. That's just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Michael in Wauwatosa, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, I just thought I would report what I think is one of the first harbingers of spring. Yesterday I heard the local cardinal singing on the top of its lungs, and that just made me feel like, yep, not too far off. But the length of day must be just getting right that they're starting to, you know, let the other cardinals know that this is my territory.
Man, well, I love that song.
I love the song of the male cardinal, and I've not heard one yet, but I'll have to stick my nose out the door this afternoon and see if anybody's singing. But it's I think part of the problem is it's just been so darn cold, people aren't outside hearing or seeing what they might normally see or hear. The horned owls have been hooting for quite a while, but a cardinal's a lot more fun to listen to than a horned owl at 2 o'clock in the morning.
I have one other wildlife report. My girlfriend and I go for evening walks along the Menominee River, and now that it's frozen, you can kind of zigzag back and forth. And about a week ago, we saw one buck with it had a half a rack. So we decided maybe we should go back and see if we can find sheds. And so we started from one end, and we zigzagged back and forth, and we had counted about 13 does and fawns. And at the end of the walk, for the evening, we came across a group of 7 bucks.
Wow.
One had, and there was the one with half a rack, but there was different, you know, different size racks. We were just astounded. And of course, we didn't have a camera or anything. But
so they were all still carrying racks?
Yeah.
Oh.
I was really surprised.
And yeah, that's a little...
How common is it for them to be, like, in an all-male group like that?
Not particularly uncommon this time of year. They gather back up, and they're more concerned about a favorable spot with a food source and a good bedding area and some security than there's no reason anymore past the rut that they would
not be together.
A bachelor group of bucks like that, the animosity level is down, as are the hormones. But I'm surprised so many were still carrying racks. You know, they start dropping them in December, even sometimes before or during the holiday hunt over Christmas and New Year's. And but on the other hand, when the DNR is doing aerial surveys, which they're doing some of this year, they still see an occasional buck with antlers, you know, well into March and so forth, as long as the snow covers. So.
Yep.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'd like to see a group of 7 bucks about the third week of November. Oh, well.
I saw 2 together. That's as many as I've seen together at that time of the year, Scott. And counted myself real lucky to see 2. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate the call. Again, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. We got some upcoming events I just wanted to make before we go back to the phones. We got, I'll be at Garden Expo. You'll be at Garden Expo coming up this weekend.
Yep, that's this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Energy Center, Lion Energy Center in Madison. That'll be pretty cool. And
I'm going to be there Saturday morning at 9.
I'm not sure when I'm going to be there. But
Lisa Johnson and I are giving a little presentation about 9 o'clock.
I know David and Jamie, who are also on the show with you, my colleagues in the wildlife program, will be there the whole time, at least one of them, and they're both giving a couple seminars in the seminar room, so that'll be good stuff. And then, 2 weeks down the line, the Fishing Expo is here in Madison. That's a good sign of spring, and that'll get everybody's blood flowing. Big National Pheasant Fest is coming up in Milwaukee, and I think that's late next week. I don't have the exact date, but Pheasant Fest attracts thousands of people. And this is also the time of the year, the banquet circuit for all the various conservation groups. So I know the Wild Turkey Federation's Mad City Gobblers are having their banquet on February 20th, but there are dozens of these things. Rocky Mountain Elk, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Wild Turkey Federation, Whitetails Unlimited. There are a scad of them. Yeah. They're all over the state.
And I think I've been invited to every one.
Well, they can be a fun evening.
Yeah, they are.
If you've never gone to one, go. You get a pretty good meal. You may win something cool.
Yeah.
And the money that you're spending on both the ticket and all the raffles and silent auctions and whatnot goes to benefit conservation for lots of different species. You know, like obviously the Rough Grouse Society is interested in grouse, but also all forest wildlife and good forest stewardship. Pheasants Forever is interested in habitat conservation. It's a really easy way for people to get some support into the mainstream of conservation. And without these groups, a whole lot of land conservation and management wouldn't be happening. So it's a cool thing to do, and the groups are doing a lot of good work. And then finally, February 14 to 17 is the 17th Great Backyard Bird Count.
Yes.
And all these folks who are sending in cool pictures and obviously keeping an eye on things outside their windows might want to, if they have not participated, they might want to think about participating in the Backyard Bird Count. And basically all they need to do is enter their results. The website, and this is run by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, is www.birdsource.org/GBBC for Great Backyard Bird Count. And somewhere I had the statistics of how many people participated.
A lot of people.
Where that? Oh, last year, 134,000 participants.
Isn't that amazing?
With close to 35 million individual birds counted.
Wow.
So it's a great data source for ornithologists interested in studying bird population trends and movement patterns and all. This is another case where while you're sitting there over your bowl of Wheaties in the morning, you can participate in data collection on the birds that you really like. So that's the 14th to the 17th. Cool thing to do.
You betcha. Joan in Whitefish Bay has a comment, I believe. Joan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, you're welcome. I'm finding your program so interesting. Yes, I saw two beautiful, I mean really, really and wonderful, wonderful fur coats. My son said they're coyotes. To me, they look more like wolves, but they had a thin, narrow nose, which would indicate they were coyotes. But is there such a thing as the migration of the coy wolf from Canada and the East Coast? Could they now be coming to Wisconsin? That's my one question. Is there the possibility of I having seen two
an Eastern coyote.
Coy wolves? The second question is an observation that we have a lot of cardinals who enjoy our black sunflower seeds, and that's all we have in one feeder, and they come to that morning and night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question, do you know about that, the coy wolf?
Well, we learned a long time ago in the program to never say never about anything, and there are coy wolves, there are coy dogs, there are wolf dogs. They're probably not coy wolves, because wolves will kill the coyotes if they get the chance, but there is interbreeding, and some parts of the country are notorious for higher prevalence of these kinds of hybrids, but not Wisconsin. And I think that while I would again say that anything's possible, given your description and just playing the odds, I think you saw a couple of really nice furry coyotes that are enjoying the winter with their nice fur coats, and there's no reason to try and make more of it than that. Mm. So I think you probably saw two normal coyotes.
Yeah.
Just beautiful. I live on the lake, and they were walking along the lake bank in the snow at the top of the bank.
Well, I mean, it's a nice observation, but the odds are certainly in favor, especially once you mention the narrow nose, that they were coyotes. And what about the lots of cardinals was just an observation, or were you going to ask about their food preferences?
Well, no, that was an observation. I think they love the black, oily sunflower seeds.
Oh, yeah.
They do, but apparently their favorite, if you win the lottery some afternoon, it's a more expensive seed, but they really like safflower, too.
Oh.
S-A-F-F flower. Safflower rather than sunflower. It's a white, kind of an oblong or more plump seed than a sunflower. And they really like those, too, but they are a little more expensive. But they'll do just fine on all I feed are black oil sunflowers, so it works fine.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. And certainly looking forward to what you have to ask and what you have to say. I hope you'll join us at 800-642-1234. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, post a question or a comment there. Scott,
I mean, people are asking a little bit about rodents. So that's another, mice in the house. What do you do about mice in the house?
The one rodent we had the picture of on the Facebook page a little while ago, that's one you don't have to worry about in the house. Voles, even though there are a number of different species, rarely, if ever, come into a building, garage, outbuilding, house, or anything else. Now, the various mice, on the other hand, especially the native field mice, the white-footed mice, deer mice, the ones with the white bellies and white feet and the big eyes, cute little things, sort of, if you can get that close to a rodent. Those are the ones that, along with house mice, that are non-native, that can cause all sorts of grief in the winter. Now, for whatever reason, I live, as you know, in the country, and I'm surrounded by our prairie restoration, so most winters I'm plagued by white-footed mice. So I have a perimeter defense of mouse traps in the garage and in the basement. But I've only had one or two catches all winter. Now, I haven't been particularly active either with the heart issues. But I'm thinking that maybe, and maybe some listeners can confirm or refute this, that it got so cold so fast that these animals, rather than, you know, kind of making the slow movement as it gets colder in the fall to inhabit my garage, outbuilding, and basement, got cut off, essentially, wherever they happen to be. I don't know. But it's been a fairly benign year for field rodents in the house. But if people are having problems with them, the field mice in particular are a wintertime problem only. They'll leave again in the spring. But minimize in your garage or outbuildings storage of bird seed, dog food, other pet foods, things like that. And if you are storing them, get a metal trash can or something that's rodent-proof and keep the food items in there. That'll help a lot. Beyond that, plain old snap trap line will thin them out before they actually get into the house, and that's really about the size of it.
We don't have any in the house, and I thought we had some in the garage, and so I set traps, and I kept catching voles, which I didn't want to catch, so I quit.
Well, or you catch the other little short-tailed guys that you don't want to catch if you can avoid it, are the short-tailed shrews, the charcoal gray ones, which are actually in there to eat the mice.
Yeah, I know.
So they're unfortunately collateral damage in the trapping operation.
All right. Oh, Jim and Holman, thanks a lot for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Larry and Scott. Real quick story. I have a son that lives in Alaska. Yeah. He's originally from Wisconsin, but he was ice fishing recently, and he catches a nice trout through the ice, and about a 20-inch trout. He throws it on the ice, and a little while later, an eagle comes along, snatches it in his talons, and flies away.
Oh, man.
Needless to say, he was a little upset, but the eagle had a nice meal anyway.
Oh, that's a good story. I like that.
I had that happen on the Rainbow Flowage a couple winters ago. We were tip-up fishing, and I guess it was on a jig pole while we had some tip-ups out. I caught a pretty good-sized white sucker, which I didn't really want, so I flipped it out on the ice, and it was flopping there, and we'd seen an eagle sitting in a snag, kind of watching over the situation, but a good long ways away, and I think that sucker made about two flops, and all of a sudden the eagle launched itself, and it just made a beeline, and whomp, grabbed the sucker and was gone. So many of these animals, from eagles to deer to the squirrels and birds at your feeders, learn very quickly what side of the bread the butter's on, and they know how to find food when they need to. So I wasn't too upset. I wasn't concerned about losing the sucker, but the son would probably want to head other designs on the trout.
That's true, yes. Yeah, thanks for your show.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Great story. Appreciate it. Well, Jim and Camp Douglas, let's turn to you next. Hi, thank you for calling.
All right. Hey, thanks, guys. I got a couple things, and I'll hang up and take the comments offline. But I see the horned larks along the edge of the roadways now, and in the past, I've kind of associated them with the coming of spring. I'm not sure if they're a migratory bird or not. And then I noticed a few more of the indigo buntings around my property last summer and fall. A very, very pretty blue male that they're hard to see sometimes, but when you do see them, you won't forget them.
Yep.
Then being a graduate of Stevens Point, I had a forestry class with Jay Cravens, and I was just wondering if that's an associate of yours. So I'll hang up and take my comments offline.
All right. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
Okay, so in reverse order, on the Jay Cravens issue, associate, yes, relative, no. There's an S on his name, none on mine.
Yeah.
So not a relative. On the Horned Lark matter, you know, we mentioned those a few minutes ago with the snow buntings as being a flocking northern bird that moves down here in the winter, likes open roadsides and very visible when they're on the roadsides, and then they hang around until things break up pretty well and clear up in the spring, and then they're gone again to go back north for nesting. So they are a winter migrant. And as far as the indigo buntings are concerned, I suspect people really not into birds see an indigo bunting and it's brilliant blue and it becomes a blue bird, which technically it isn't, but it is blue and they're even more blue than a bluebird. And kind of favors, you know, open, brushy, sedgy, grassy open areas. And if you get a pair or two around, you can see them pretty regularly and they're pretty conspicuous when they're around. So hopefully they'll hang out there for Jim's viewing pleasure.
Amy in southeast Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. My question is, we have a den of fox, and they're usually here every year. One of the females are come back. And I would like to feed them, like, a fish scrap. Is that a good idea, or should I just to help them along until spring for the babies, or is that a bad idea?
Well, you're putting me on the spot here. But I'm going to have to... I'm going to have to stick with the party. There are a couple of reasons why the feeding is perhaps a poor idea or ill-advised. And I think the major one is just the risk. Foxes become pretty habituated to people anyway. And they'll dig a den in a place where you would, good grief, you'd never think a fox would den. Case in point being the family that's currently living underneath one of our 12-story campus buildings, right in the heart of campus, right along the edge of this huge building, probably no more than 50 feet from a sidewalk used on a daily basis by 20,000 college students, and the fox are oblivious to that. However,
don't they do that for protection from the coyote?
Yes, among other things. They do get driven into some of our urban areas by coyote pressure, but they also know a good spot when they find it, and an area like a campus or a neighborhood that's got lots of rabbits and voles and other things and not a whole lot of predators, including coyotes, hey, this is a good spot. And if people don't bother me, I'm going to stay. But by feeding them, you kind of raise that whole habituation of people to another level, and all of a sudden they view people as a source of food. And if they start to get close to... They probably don't distinguish from Joe, from Frank, from Mary, from Sally. And if, in this case, Amy's feeding them, but they approach Sally three doors down, and Sally's not sure what's going on, and all of a sudden thinks, oh, my gosh, it's a rabid fox, a dangerous fox, it's too close to the kids or whatever, then all of a sudden the foxes are in trouble.
Yeah.
Chances are... they're doing just fine with the rodents and other things that are around the neighborhood and probably don't need the handout. So the bottom line is I think the risk is greater than the reward. Let them fend for themselves.
I had an experience this morning. I'm just about ready to sneeze here. that's why I stopped. Sorry. I was talking with someone from the Department of Soil Science. They have, and the Soil Science building, she happened to be looking outside, and one of those fox was going along the street and got to the crosswalk, the marked crosswalk, and turned to go across, but there was a car coming. So it sat patiently, waited for the car to go by, and then went on the crosswalk, which the person said she was much better than the students often are.
Yes, much better.
Oh, my goodness. Cedar and Grandview. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, I was going to ask, we saw a bird maybe about 2 years ago, but the eyes were either covered over with blood or had been plopped out, but the bird could find its way to food and water easily.
Hmm. So you're pretty sure the eyes were plucked out?
Well, I mean, maybe even covered over with blood. I'm not quite sure, but it didn't look like the eyes were there.
Hmm.
And I was able to pick up the bird and hold the bird because it couldn't see me when I would come up to it.
Wow.
But it could still find food. Do you know what it was?
It was a purple finch, I think.
Okay, yeah. Because finches are prone to a problem called conjunctivitis, which affects their eyes and can kind of skim them over and even provide kind of a crusty growth on the eyes and so forth, which might give the impression that they've been damaged or not there.
Mm-hmm.
In an interspecies interaction, eyes can get pecked out and so forth. But as soon as you mentioned finch, I think of conjunctivitis and that it was a disease problem, and its vision undoubtedly was compromised, allowing you to pick it up. What happened to it, I don't know.
Yeah.
But that would be my best guess on what was going on.
Yeah, conjunctivitis. You can look that one up, Cedar.
Okay, I will.
Yeah. All right, okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Sounds like one of our younger listeners. Mm-hmm. It's always great to have our young listeners join in. And, of course, our older ones, too. We always like to have them on as well. And that number to call, by the way, is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. Saf Hour, just in quick before the news, Becca says hardly anything but cardinals eat safflower. She says she can't get squirrels to even eat it. So,
well, there you go. If you want to favor your cardinals, use safflower.
News is next. Stay with us. Here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, I'm Larry Mehler with my guest, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, retired from the University of Wisconsin, but still working pretty hard. We have so many great regular guests. They come by to spend time talking with you and with me, sharing what they know, and probably few have as much a following as Scott Craven. We hear often from you that getting to hear Scott explain animal behavior and give us tips what to watch for this time of the year is wonderful. He's back. He comes by once a month. And Scott, thanks again for spending time with us.
Happy to be here, Larry.
Appreciate it very, very much. Lots of callers online. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. We were trying to figure out dates for Pheasant Fest, and Julie at Pheasants Forever called in and said Pheasants Fest in Milwaukee is February 14th through the 16th at the Wisconsin Center. So 14th through the 16th at the Wisconsin Center. So there you go. Trisha in Antioch, Illinois has a question for you. Hi, Trisha.
Hi. Great show. I just wanted to comment that when we were kids, we rescued a baby blue jay that fell from really high in a tree down by the lake where we lived. And our mom explained to us that when the little pin feathers came in and blossomed into these beautiful, you know, blues and all the colors and striations that a blue jay has, she said that they were related to crows. So the reason I'm bringing this up is the gentleman that called in about the odd bird that was in their cherry tree that was looked somewhat like a jay but was darker. I wondered if it could evolutionarily be a throwback genetically.
Probably not. I mean, genetics is a kind of a weird thing, and mutations and malformations and assorted other things can create all sorts of strange creatures. But you're correct in that in the family, crows and jays are related, which is an issue with that group being susceptible to West Nile virus, which was what we mentioned with the dead animal on another call. But they're still separate species, and there wouldn't be any genetic movement. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of a different example to give you that Well, I mean, a lion and a tiger are both cats, but
yeah,
there wouldn't be a throwback that would make a lion look like a tiger, or vice versa. So,
yeah.
Interesting thought, and they are related. You're correct about that, but I don't think that it gets us toward an answer for what he was seeing.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Trish. Rich in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi. I was calling it just to talk about a little bit that we had silver robins that are always in our yard. They're eating on the apple trees. But just last week, we had another bird in a tree that looked similar to a robin, and we looked it up in the book, in one of our books, and I believe it was a towhee. Is that common?
Well, the rufous-sided towhee is it's kind of a black, white, and orangey bird with large patches of color. It's a woodland bird. Has a very cool, for people learning bird songs, the towhee's call is described as drink your tea, and it's a very easy one to learn to recognize. Not a bird that I've heard of being seen in the winter, though. They're a little more slender than a robin. But again, as we've mentioned repeatedly on the program, we never rule anything out. So if
right,
it's a pretty distinctive bird, yeah, if that's what you think you saw, then so be it. You saw a towhee, which is a pretty
right,
cool, which is a pretty cool record.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Well, we never see them during the summer, and that's the first time we've ever seen it. And actually, it was there like 3 days in a row.
Huh.
So we had plenty of time to look in the book and compare it. And there's no doubt there's a very distinct white patch kind of on its
yes,
side that,
yep,
that was like a dead giveaway. So,
well,
yeah,
that's an interesting. They're not a typical feeder bird at any time of the year. So that's a pretty cool observation.
Yeah, yeah, thanks for all letting right, us know, Rich. Appreciate it very much. Speaking of birds at a feeder, if we could just take a look at my Facebook page here. Gail sent us a picture of, I think, you got a whole flock of turkeys at her feeder. She said they came to visit about a month ago, and they have returned every day since to help themselves to the feed under the bird feeders and what we put on the ground for the ground feeders. Needless to say, our food bill has risen.
Yeah, a flock of turkeys like that can clean up a lot of seed, but it's with the snow and cold, we have a tough situation for the turkeys as well as other birds. So as long as they're willing to keep putting out a little extra feed for the turkeys to scratch up, then it's a good thing for them and the turkeys.
And here we have another photo from Walter from Chippewa County, and it's a fox that showed up at his bird feeding area on December in 2013. He said, I put some dog biscuits out, and it came back each night for about a month, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, the cool thing about that one is it's not a red fox, it's a gray fox, which is a little more of a woodland, I don't want to say wary, but a little more obscure animal for most folks than the red fox that most people are seeing around suburbs or the den I mentioned here on campus or whatnot. But that's a gray, and they're just a beautiful animal. They're a little bit smaller, very pretty. One of the few members of the canid family or dog family that can climb pretty well. So that's a neat picture and a neat thing to have at your feeder.
Tony in Mequon, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. You're talking birds here, and I have feeders out in Beck, and every year about this time I get a bird, not unlike a sparrow, but they have some red on them, little spurts of red on their chest, I think, in Beck. I looked in my book, and all I could find was something called a red pole that migrates from Canada. And I wonder if you had anything that
would confirm that. Yeah.
Well, red poles are a highly desirable winter feeder bird that have a red kind of a red spot on the top of their head.
They come in spring by me, yeah.
Yeah, red poles have been pretty uncommon this winter for most folks. But a sparrow-sized bird, if the red... I think you said was kind of on their breast a little bit or throat.
There wasn't a whole lot on him, but they do have some red on them, yeah.
Yeah.
On the throat or?
I mean, I'd
you
be.
You have to look pretty hard, but it's there.
On the crown or on the throat or?
I think it's more on the body, on the throat maybe. And
okay.
Because that sounds more like a house finch to me,
yeah,
which is.
Me too.
Which are very common at feeders and have more red on them than a redpole was at wood, and they're sparrow-sized and behave sort of like sparrows. But check out a house finch in your bird book too, Tony, and see if that looks possible.
Yeah, I bet that's what it is. One of the birds we have coming to ours feeders as well. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. We have, by the way, another photo. Oh, I have lots of photos on my Facebook page. If you're on Facebook or have a chance to go, if you have a computer, go to my Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. That's where you need to go. You don't have to be a member of Facebook to go to it. And there's a picture of a Cooper's hawk, according to John, waiting for the sparrows to vacate his arborvitae.
Yeah, well, if I was a sparrow, I certainly wouldn't visit that feeder for a seed right then. That's a dangerous spot, but it's a good photo.
Yeah, really good photo. Ann in Madison, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, this is sort of a general question, but I was wondering, I know that small animals use brush piles once in a while when they're covered with snow, because I have one in my backyard, and I seem to see squirrels and maybe some other little furry creatures going in and out in various tunnels. But I wondered where most birds go that stay in the state in a winter like this when it's 20 below zero. Do they have to be up high, or do they burrow in somewhere or get under bushes or what?
Well, there are a couple of possibilities. First, two things that you mentioned, Ann, worth following up on here. One is that a brush pile is a very attractive wildlife feature around someone's yard or home. And it's a common kind of weekend-type project that a lot of the wildlife habitat guides will recommend that you create one, either because it's gotten hard in some communities to put brush out to be picked up for the landfill. They just won't do it anymore. So building a little brush pile, if you've got a corner of the yard where you can, you're willing to do it, starting out with the largest possible wood stock that you have, even log-like stuff in a kind of a crisscross pattern, and then covering it with brush teepee fashion, all kinds of things will use a well-constructed brush pile, from small mammals to, during the summer, reptiles and amphibians, and the birds will get into that too. But generally, most of our smaller birds that are at the feeders during the day, at night, around my house, for example, I've got a number of pretty dense white fir, arborvitae, and a couple of spruce. And they will get in those, and if I happen to let the dog out late at night and brush by one of the arborvitae, there's a great flapping of wings and birds bailing out in all directions. So they'll get into evergreens, and conifers and so forth to just get up against the trunk and get out of the wind. That's one of the key things. Hollows in trees, you know, chickadees will pile into a hollow tree or a nest cavity. Birdhouses and boxes that are put out for nesting may also be used for roosting, as well as the brush piles. And in some cases, I have birds go up underneath the decks and roost on the joists or on anything they can get a perch on underneath the deck and up against the house. So they find a sheltered spot where they're out of the wind and seem to do okay.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Yeah, thanks, Ann. Thank you for calling. We have Rich and Mellon next. Hi, Rich.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks for calling.
It was my pleasure. You touched on bird bass earlier. You can't stress enough how important it is to the birds this time of year to have a bird bath, a form of water.
Mm-hmm.
Because in actuality, our area becomes a desert in the wintertime. We have snow, but it's not a liquid form. So I found that heating a bird feeder, or even now, like you can get these heated dog dishes, put a rock in the middle of it for the birds to sit on, and it gives them the water that they dearly need.
Yep, it's a very important feature, and as cold as it's been, you know, most winters we'll get a periodic thaw, or the sun's high enough in the sky that there's a little water dripping on the south side of a building or something like that. But, boy, there hasn't even been much of that for the last couple of months. So
no.
Heated bird bath, like the caller mentioned earlier, is really attractive.
Yeah,
it is. And you also touched on that great back air bird count. I do write a little bit on nature up in this area, and I stress of taking a child's hand that back air bird count is an excellent way to take a child and sit down by a window and just count birds and get them used to the outdoors, get them away from the other things, but see what's real out there.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Rich. Appreciate it. Very, very good idea. Larry in Two Rivers has a question. Hi, Larry.
Good afternoon. In the spirit of looking forward to spring, here's an observation I made in May of 2013. I want to confirm to see if I'm correct. I went to Peterson's Guide on North American Birds and believe I saw almost 100% a western tanager. Could that be possible?
Sure.
Yep.
Yep, it's possible. You can. You could probably. Yes, it's possible. And you could probably verify the frequency with which that bird has shown up by either checking with a local Audubon Society or
Breeding Bird Atlas.
The Breeding Bird Atlas, or alternatively, there's another book by Temple and Carey called A Seasonal and Geographic Guide to Wisconsin Birds, and it lists the unusual sightings along with their frequency and numbers here in Wisconsin. So a couple of ways to verify it, but yes, it's certainly possible.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Facebook question from Gail. Why would an owl make a kamikaze dive into the grill of our car? Needless to say, he didn't survive.
I'm sorry. I'm not laughing at the fate of the owl.
Bluebird.
That's unfortunate, but I'm guessing they must have been driving at the time. Yeah. And the owl was going from point A to point B, and whomp, their paths crossed, end of owl. It's also possible there was something else the owl was pursuing or thought it saw that that Gail or the driver didn't see. And again, the car and the owl came together. So, you know, unfortunately, cars are a huge mortality source
yeah.
for all forms of Wisconsin wildlife. And this is another example. But the reasons behind this accident, we will probably never know.
At some of the, I remember during the grab hour of the great bicycle run across along the Wisconsin River, which was five hundred miles, I think. But just riding 500 miles on a bike along the roadside,
what you
over
see?
The course of a week,
yeah.
and the number of birds and insects and other little animals that you see that have been hit by cars. I mean, you don't realize it until you're going along at a kind of a slow pace like that, but covering a fair distance in mm-hmm. a day. It's a lot.
It's a lot.
Yeah. Will in Kiel, thank you for calling. Hi.
Yes, Will calling from Kiel. You may have answered this question already. I tuned in kind of late, but we've been feeding birds for a number of years. We live in a rural area. And this year, I'm in eastern Wisconsin. And for whatever reason, we have just a very few goldfinches. And normally when I hang out my sack with Niger seed, they're hanging on there. I fill the sack just once this whole year. And we also have no pine siskins, which we have a lot of, and also crossbills we haven't seen. Is there some reason for that this year?
Well, I'm sure there is, but I'm not sure I can tell you what it is, Will. But generally speaking, the earlier in the winter, I thought it might have changed by now, but there were very poor numbers of some of the northern birds like siskins, redpolls, crossbills, and grosbeaks mm-hmm. down from the north, and that still seems to be the case. As far as the goldfinches are concerned, I've not had nearly as many goldfinches as I normally have in southern Dane County. But I have a friend with a large shelf feeder outside a big picture window up in Minocqua, and he was just telling me the other day that he's had as many as 50 goldfinches or more at a time on that shelf feeder.
Wow.
So for whatever reason, maybe
they must have enough food where they are.
They must have enough food where they are, so they're doing okay.
Okay, well, thanks for your answer.
Yep.
Thanks a lot for calling. Here we've got a bunch of really good photos on my Facebook page. Sandy sent us one. She's been trying to identify these birds the past that visited this past March. They look just like the Red Cross bills in my bird books, but the bills were not crossed. So I'm not coming up with anything either here, Scott, so I hope you can come up with something.
Well, I from a distance until I got up and came over here, I thought we were, I thought it was just a pair of house finches, but the coloration doesn't look right on the female or male. So we're going to have to turn to our cadre of tens of thousands of expert birders out there. And if somebody can check the Facebook page and give us an idea that would be very helpful. And a couple of nice young fox there.
Well, they're really
pretty
cute.
Good pictures.
Yeah, some really good photos.
And
here.
A really nice snowy owl.
Really nice snowy owl.
And more turkeys. Who knew?
Oh, man. There was another one, too, I thought, somewhere. Huh? I think we said we slow. Oh, Dan sent a. he does hand carved fish decoys, but she sent a really pretty one there, a photo of one. Wonder about the prospects of ice and spear fishing conditions for Winnebago next week. I haven't
heard a thing about that coming up. I didn't even know the season was about to open, but I don't know. I'm assuming there's quite a bit of snow cover unless the wind has swept things clear, and I don't know anything about the water conditions. So I know some of the northern lakes, the fellow who keeps an eye on our cabin in Price County said, don't even bother, come up and try and fish. He said, there's so much snow you can hardly get around. And when you do cut a hole, the weight of all the snow, you've got 6 inches of slush and water on top of the ice. You're miserable. Don't know what the conditions are in Winnebago.
John in Mineral Point, thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Larry and Scott. I have several juncos hopping around my bird feeder on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And on two legs, and then I'll see him standing on one, and then in a minute I'll pull it up and stand on the other, and my question is, do birds get cold feet?
Well, to a degree, yes, although they've got a circulatory mechanism to minimize that problem because there's obviously not much insulation there. But they will. A lot of birds will pick a foot up and just essentially rest it and warm it up. But I was watching last week, as I mentioned earlier, I was in Florida sitting on the beach in the evening, and it certainly wasn't a cold issue, but the gulls around us on the beach were pulling up a foot, too, and tucking that in the feathers and standing on one foot. So it's both. It can be both a resting and a warming mechanism.
So there you go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And, boy, I tell you what, we've covered a lot of things. I know the DNR, we should probably mention the deer changes. We've got about maybe a minute to go here. There were a lot of changes.
Well, yeah, I think it's worth mentioning to folks. We've been talking about this for months. The rules package that went before the Natural Resources Board last week on Tuesday, I think, dealt with all of the recommendations that came from the public hearings, the public committees, and all the digestion of the so-called Deer Czar, Deer Trustees Report, the Kroll Report, whole series of wide-ranging recommendations ranging from changing the deer management unit boundaries to county boundaries, getting rid of on-site deer registration, changing the way deer populations are monitored and assessed. Wide-ranging package of stuff. It was all passed by the board last Tuesday, and implementation will begin this coming year and spread into 2015. So it would behoove all deer hunters or people interested in deer in general to get a copy of the regulations packet and see what the heck is going to be different, because there's a lot of different stuff. So we're entering a really different period in deer management in Wisconsin.
Well, you and I will keep track of that and look forward to your visit next month, the first Wednesday of March.
March. I love March.
Hopefully the weather will be a lot better. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. Thanks to him, and thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.